Blog Talk Radio.
Well, good evening, everybody. Tricia Griffith here with our very own Kimster, and we are what we call True Crime Radio. Thank you for joining us tonight. We have some very, very interesting topics. The big news, and I love it when I am wrong, because I thought he would be found not guilty. I think I'm just so scared after the Casey Anthony case. Drew Peterson found guilty, and now the word is that they are going to proceed in perhaps filing charges against him for the disappearance of Stacey Peterson. Now, the gentleman we've had on our show a few times, Jeff Ruby, has put up a $100,000 reward for information leading to the body and the recovery of the body of Stacey Peterson. I think with that reward and with the newfound interest and the everything kind of whirling around it, I do believe we will find her body, or at least the blue barrel that it was put in. But one thing Drew Peterson said, he said that he could kill someone and hide the body and they could never find it. I hope we can prove him wrong, because we've proved him wrong about Kathleen Savio, his third wife, and when he said I could kill her and make it look like an accident. No, you can't, you big jerk. Okay, Levi Page was supposed to call in 5 minutes ago, and he even texted me a few moments ago and said he'd be here. So when he gets on here, he will promptly be smacked. Who's in our chat room? Let's see. Hey, everybody. And our second guest. Oh, this is great. His name is Greg Day. He's an author, and he's written a book called Untying the Knot, John Mark Byers and the West Memphis Three. Now, you remember the West Memphis Three, Damien Echols, Jason Baldwin, and Jesse Miskelly. They were convicted, and Damien was put on death row for the murders of 3 8-year-olds, Stephen Branch, Michael Moore, and Christopher Byers. Well, it was very apparent that they were innocent, and they were released. But if you saw those HBO specials, okay, the first two of the specials, Paradise Lost, they kind of focused on John Mark Byers. Now, I believe Christopher Byers was his stepson, and it made it look like he did it. I thought for sure he did it. He came across as this big, huge, crazy criminal, weirdo freak, and I don't know how you could watch that HBO special, one of the first ones was in the early 90s, I believe, and not just go, John Mark Byers, he did it, there's no question. Well, this just goes to show you how the media can manipulate everything and why we must always keep an open mind about cases. Anyway, Mr. Day, Greg Day, will be on with us. He will be talking about the book he wrote about John Mark Byers, and it looks at the case from a different angle. It discusses Damien, Jason, and Jesse, and the murdered boys, but it looks at it through what happened to John Mark Byers. I have a feeling, I haven't read the book yet, but I have a feeling HBO paid him a lot of money to act crazy weird. And, you know, I can act crazy weird for free. But apparently, if you're HBO, they'll pay you to do it. So we'll find out more about that when Mr. Day gives us a buzz. And let's see, Kimster there he is, Levi Page. You little rascal. Hold on 1 second. You're coming up. There you are. Can you hear me?
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, Levi. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, you bet. Well, listen, I opened the show and I said I am so delighted that I am wrong about Drew Peterson, because I was so worried he was going to be found not guilty. And you were right. You said that you felt he would be found guilty. Now, we did a spreecast together, and if nobody knows what a spreecast is, it's a very interesting way of doing a talk show. You're basically on TV on the computer. Levi has his own spreecast, and I join him every Friday night to talk about true crime. And it's a great way to bring everybody together and talk about true crime, just like this radio show. But Levi, since we talked Friday, I've been searching around, and I haven't found a whole lot new. Just that the thing I have found interesting is it's pretty much been decided that if it had not been for the hearsay, Drew Peterson would have been found not guilty. Do you agree?
Yeah, I agree, because I think that the case hinged on what Stacey Peterson had told people like the pastor, Neil Shorey, what she had told Kathleen Savio's divorce attorney, Harry Smith, and from what she had told some of her friends and people close to her about what Drew Peterson had done to her, such as the abuse, sneaking into her home at night, holding a knife to her, and making threats towards her. They probably would not even have a case if it was not for the hearsay law.
Well, that's true, but if I remember correctly, and please correct me here, the law was passed pretty much so that information could be brought into this trial. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it'll be used in other cases, but it was passed before the trial was started, before he was arrested, wasn't it? Or was it?
I think so, that they passed it. I don't know if it was before his arrest or after his arrest, but it was passed specifically for this case.
Exactly.
Because there were things that Stacy Peterson and Kathleen Savio had told people, and obviously Kathleen Savio is dead, Stacy Peterson is presumed dead. You know, they needed to have a way to get that in. And if you eliminate a witness against you that has incriminating evidence against you, then obviously there has to be a way to get it in. Because
there has to be a consequence.
Because we can't give fillers like Drew Peterson the benefit or give them, you know, an edge because they kill someone that has evidence against them.
Exactly, and that's what Drew Peterson thought he was doing, Levi, is he thought he was gaining the edge because he was so smart, and now, like I said, I just want to wipe that smirky, disgusting smile off his face.
And Trisha, you know, it shows you what type of person that Drew Peterson is, that he eliminates people that have evidence against him and what he's capable of doing. I mean, can you imagine what he would do after if he was found not guilty? What would happen afterwards? Who he would go after? Who he would target? Because he's obviously so arrogant that he thinks he can get away with it, that he killed two women. And Beth Karras from In Session was interviewing Neil Shorey, the pastor, and he told her that when he was talking to Stacy Peterson at the Starbucks, that's when Stacy confided in him that she knew that Drew killed Kathleen Savio, because the night that Kathleen Savio died, Drew Peterson had snuck out of the house. He had came back with women's clothing, and that he later coached her on what to tell law enforcement when they questioned her about Kathleen's murder. And Neil Shorey says that when they were talking about that in the Starbucks, that a Bolingbrook police car, patrol car, was circling the Starbucks, and that it was most likely Drew Peterson that was doing it, and that he later found out that Stacy met with Neil, called Neil, and said, "I know you met with my wife," and he wanted to know why, and Neil would not share that with him. And this was, I think, 2 days before Stacy vanished that he made that telephone call to Neil, and he invited him on his, you know, he has an airplane, you know, a mini airplane that he rides around. He invited him to take a ride with him on that airplane. And a lot of people think that he was going to maybe push him out. And then an accident, he fell out.
And that's just it.
So that shows you what he's capable of. And
exactly.
That would fit in. He killed C.C. Peterson.
Exactly. Levi, you're fading out just a little bit, so I'll let you drive for a little bit and follow up on what you're saying there. You're fading out just a little bit, so I'll let you drive a little bit and get in a better zone, and I'll follow up on what you said. And you're right. I do believe he would have pushed the pastor out of the airplane, and I'm sure the pastor knew that too, and he was very smart not to get into that.
Mm-hmm.
No, don't get into any moving vehicle of any type with Drew Peterson is probably very good advice. And Levi, you brought up a great point. Just think of how arrogant he would have been if he had been found not guilty. If I was the pastor, I'd have been worried. If I was the divorce lawyer, I would have been worried, because he is that arrogant that he would have, I bet, tried to kill his witnesses even more so, even gone after them with such a vengeance. But now, with that $100,000 reward and Drew Peterson behind bars, I fully have faith that somebody is going to come forward and say, "Here's the deal." Boom. And then we're off to the races, and we can get him for Stacy Peterson, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is a man who you know, look back at the Kathleen Savio case. He consulted a man to help him get a hitman to kill Kathleen Savio. And Drew Peterson even came up with a code word with that man, and even said that Drew Peterson even said that he was going to go to another county, was going to go to a place, I forgot, I think it was Six Flags Theme Park. He was going to get into a fight with someone there to establish an alibi that when Kathleen was murdered, so they could not tie him to it. So we know that Drew Peterson might have done the same thing with Stacy. Did he hire a hitman to kill Stacy? I mean, that's a possibility.
Absolutely.
And maybe with Drew Peterson behind bars, somebody is going to speak out and say something, because there's obviously someone who threatens people, who talks to people. He's very arrogant. Maybe he told somebody what he did. I wouldn't rule that out either, because this is someone who went up to Kathleen Savio and said, I could kill you and make it look like an accident. So
right.
Who knows what sort of witnesses are out there. And James Glasgow says that they are going to be pursuing this aggressively and look into the possibility of charging him with Stacy's murder.
And that is such a wonderful thing to hear. But you're absolutely right. He could have opened his big mouth because he is so arrogant. But now here's the fear, and this is a real fear. This just isn't me being overly cautious, Levi. Because of this hearsay law, so many lawyers are going to fight tooth and nail to get it overturned. And I've been talking to a few attorneys, and they say that it's a very real possibility that it will get overturned because of the far-reaching effects that it can have. They're all good. I mean, most of them are good, but there are some bad effects that it could have happened with this law as well. So now we have to really worry and be concerned that if that is overturned, what will happen? Even if it's, let's say the law is overturned, and so they go and they file a motion and they say this case, the Drew Peterson's case, needs to be thrown out, and they say okay, but they can refile later and try him again. Does he get out on bail? Does he stay in prison? There are so many options, but I think, Levi, for us to rest and think it's over would be foolish, because this law is very precarious in nature. That's why it's extremely important that they get Stacy Peterson and find her body so they can bring it around and keep him in there on that charge and that case if by chance it's overturned, if the law is overturned.
Well, Tricia, the basis for getting in the hearsay from Stacy Peterson was that the prosecution believed that he had killed her.
Mm-hmm.
And that is why she is not there to testify, because she's dead, because he killed her. And that's the exception to the hearsay law. But the problem is he's not been arrested or charged with her murder. So maybe it would help their case on appeal if they actually charged him with Stacy's murder and got a conviction.
You're right.
That helped them on appeal. Look, we have a conviction on him for the murder of Stacy Peterson. And I also think that this is a test case for the hearsay law. In a lot of the evidence that they got admissible in trial, this is a test case. So we'll see how it plays out.
Do you think? Well, let's go back. Let's revisit the hearsay just a little bit. There was a lot of hearsay they didn't let in. I mean, the judge was the guy who ran against the prosecutor for district attorney.
Mm-hmm.
So right there, I think he should have recused himself for just an appearance of a problem. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean he couldn't do his job properly. But the appearance was just not good, because that's someone he ran against, and apparently it was a very nasty campaign. And the judge was very defendant-friendly in this case, and he did not let a lot of that hearsay in. So I think that in itself will also help on the appeal because they can say, you know, look at this. It's not like we just allowed everything in. There was just two conversations and they were pertinent because this woman is missing and presumed dead and the defendant is the one who did it. So it kind of all ties together, and hopefully the justices that look at the case and look at the appeal will realize, hey, this hearsay law is just not about letting willy-nilly hearsay in, you know, the neighbors and the gossip. No, this is very strong and solid evidence that just happens to be hearsay. And maybe they won't overturn it, but I'm telling you.
I think that's a good point. Tricia, I think, sometimes more is less, because if you look at the Casey Anthony trial, Judge Perry allowed in a lot, and this is sort of like comparing apples and oranges, but Judge Perry let in a lot of the scientific testimony in that was very complex and very confusing. And the jury probably got confused by it and focused solely on that scientific evidence instead of the circumstantial evidence, such as the partying, not reporting the child missing for 31 days. They were bogged down in the specifics of whether or not this scientific evidence is even reliable. And sometimes more is less. And I think that in this case, more is less. They didn't allow in, you know, a bunch of crap that the jury would get bogged down in and confused in. And I think that probably ended up helping the prosecution that they only allowed in specific testimony such as Neil Shorey and Harry Smith and the stories about Drew Peterson slipping in the house and attacking her and threatening her. They only allowed in the most incriminating, so the jury didn't get bogged down in some of the hearsay that might have been unreliable or questionable.
Right, and that I think is also what is going to help them when they go for this appeal, because let me tell you what, the lawyers appealing this will have a lot of power behind them. They're going to have the defense attorneys of the nation behind them, because if this law is a test law and it stands, then other states will probably follow suit. And then what will happen is you probably will get into that gray area where they do allow some hearsay that maybe shouldn't be there. But I think it's a good law, because what it does is it eliminates the ability for somebody to kill the witnesses. Because if somebody is afraid of the person and they end up killing them, then guess what? What they talked about before they died can be let in. So, because you should not give the advantage to a defendant just because he killed the person who can testify against them.
I agree.
Now, do you think that they will bring charges against Drew without a body?
I think they may.
How do you think they could do that, though? How could they do that?
I don't think they have anything. Well, we don't know what they have. That is the point. You know, they're keeping things close to the vest. We don't know what evidence that they have collected in the Stacey Peterson case. And James Glasgow saying that it's a possibility that they could bring charges. And I think you mentioned on my show Friday night that one of Kathleen Savio's relatives was being interviewed on television, and they actually let it slip that it was a possibility that they are going to bring charges against Drew with concerning Stacey's case. So they may have evidence that we don't know about. And also, look at the Kathleen Savio case. A bulk of that came about from what Stacey Peterson had said. So they can use that evidence in the Stacey Peterson case as well. So they used the hearsay law to convict him with Kathleen's murder. They could use the hearsay law to convict him with Stacey Peterson's murder. They could probably even bring in Kathleen Savio's murder, also the fact that he's been convicted in that, and bring that into the Stacey Peterson case as well.
Well, they will be able to.
So I think that it's a strong possibility that they'll charge him with Stacey's murder. And I know that some people that have followed this case and examined some of the evidence in the Stacey Peterson case, a lot of people had said that the case with Stacey Peterson is stronger than the one with Kathleen Savio. I know many people have stated that, including Joseph Hosey, who wrote a book about Drew Peterson. He's a local reporter there in Illinois, and he stated that he thought that it might have been better for them to bring charges with Stacey instead of Kathleen.
Well, I think you're absolutely right in that now, since he has been convicted, I would assume this would fall under prior bad acts. And so they could bring it in and say, he did it to number three, he did it to number four, because number four mm-hmm. knew about number three. I mean, it's like I said, it's this hearsay. It's almost not even hearsay, because it's just this perfect link that just brings it all back around to Drew. And it's pretty solid. So we got to keep our fingers crossed that hearsay law is upheld, because Drew Peterson needs to stay behind bars because he's very dangerous. Levi Page, thank you very, very much. If you'd like, I'm going to put you on hold, and you're welcome to join in this conversation. We have Mr. Greg Day with us. So if you would like to join in, feel free. In fact, I'll just leave it open, and you can listen and ask questions if you'd like, or if you need to go, whatever works for you, Levi, okay?
Okay. Thanks for having me on, Tricia.
Okay. Wait, hold on one second. Hold on. Wait, we have a question. Kimster, what is that question? We have a question for Levi. Kim?
Hi.
Hi. We have a question for Levi.
Yes, it's from Wonder Llama. And if they use part of something the fourth wife said in order to convict on the third, how can they then use the conviction of the third to help convict on number four?
Well, because the cases are so related. I mean, that would go to the prosecution's motive that Drew Peterson killed Stacy because she was about to expose what he did to Kathleen. So that's part of their motive. That's part of the reason why he killed her, according to them. So if they couldn't bring in Kathleen's case, they probably wouldn't have much of a case. They wouldn't be able to bring in the fact that she went to Kathleen's divorce attorney, Harry Smith, and they wouldn't be able to bring into the fact that right before she went missing, she had consulted Neil Shorey about what she knew about Kathleen's murder. So the cases are intertwined. You can't really bring a case against him without bringing in Kathleen's case. They couldn't bring a case against him with Kathleen without bringing in Stacy's case. I mean, you can't separate the two. It's impossible.
That's true. They are connected forever and ever. Again, Levi Page, thank you so very, very much. We do appreciate you and appreciate all you
do.
Thanks, Levi. You're listening to Tricia's True Crime Radio, and our next guest has written a fascinating book. It's called Untying the Knot, John Mark Byers and the West Memphis Three. Now, it's fascinating in that what I have read, the little bits I've read about it, I can't wait to delve into the whole thing. Because to me, this is such a unique look at what happened in the West Memphis Three. Let me just bring you up to date in case you might have forgotten. This is from Mr. Day's website. Byers' son, Christopher, and his 2 8-year-old companions, Stevie Branch and Michael Moore, Damien Eccles, Jason Baldwin, and Jesse Miskelly Jr. are grown men now, okay? They were convicted of killing those three boys. And they have spent over 18 years in prison. They are now released as part of a plea agreement. They pleaded to a lesser crime, and they were sentenced to time served. They did an Alford plea, which means they said, we're guilty, not because we are guilty, but we just think you have enough evidence to convict us, and we're saying we're not guilty, but we're pleading guilty. That's what they did, and who can blame them for wanting to do that to get out of prison? John Mark Byers. His son, Christopher, was one of the three. Now, if you saw Paradise Lost 1 and 2 on HBO, you know John Mark Byers. I think he's about 6'7", has a booming voice, and he is a character. When I watched the first Paradise Lost, I thought for sure he did it. And that just goes to show how manipulative the media can be. And I'm going to let Mr. Greg Day talk about it because he knows it all. Mr. Day, thank you for joining us today on True Crime Radio.
Thanks for having me, Tricia. Glad to be here.
Okay, now, you know, there's so much to go. I don't even know where to start because this case is so maddening and so upsetting. There is a killer out there. And
well, let me start at the end, though, Trisha, and just to embellish one thing you said about the West Memphis Three's plea. They're not completely off scot-free. They do have 10 years supervised or unsupervised probation. So if they shortchange a merchant at a department store, they have to go back and finish their sentence.
So they've got to be very, very careful. Well, I have a feeling that they are being very, very careful. I'm sure they relish being out and free again. John Mark Byers. Okay, first of all, the young boys, they were killed. They were thrown into a river. It was, I believe, Stephen Branch. Genitals were removed. Is that correct?
No, and actually, it was Christopher Byers.
Christopher Byers, excuse me. I'm sorry. Christopher Byers' genitals removed. And it just looked like John Mark Byers did it, based on the HBO special. What can you tell us about that first special and about, and why don't you just start telling us about John Mark Byers? Let's start there.
Yeah, Mark is, obviously, he's certainly the most fascinating character I've ever met, and there's a lot of reasons why people thought things that they thought about him. He did have a huge presence on the screen, and I mean that figuratively as
literally.
Well. Yeah, he is a giant, people saw a crazy hillbilly, and it was pretty easy to connect him with the crime. But the truth is that Mark was, up until the time of Christopher's murder, he was really just, he was a jeweler, first of all. That was his trade, and he'd been a jeweler for 15 years. He'd gone to college in Paris, Texas, to be a jeweler, and he'd gone around that area of the South doing jewelry repair, but he also did a little small-time marijuana dealing, and even did a stint as an informant, and that gets a lot of attention. For some reason, supporters find it suspicious that he was an informant for the West Memphis and Memphis, Tennessee task forces. But I mean, it was a very short duration. In other words, Mark was kind of a petty criminal on the side to make a little money, and then he was basically a jeweler. And until Christopher's death, that's when things really, really changed for him. I mean, he got crazy with the things that hate and anger and a dose of drugs and alcohol will do to you. Mark, he went crazy. I mean, there's really no other way to describe it. And this was the state he was in. He was actually very sedated during the first film.
You're kidding. That was sedated?
Yes.
Wow.
For instance, I don't know if you remember the scenes where he was on the stand.
Yes.
And he was testifying about the knife. He was heavily drugged with Xanax and other. In fact, everybody was. They were handing out Valium like candy to Vicki Hutchison and Pam Hobbs, and there was a lot of sedation going on amongst the witnesses. Mark really got crazy in the second film.
Did HBO? This is something I've heard, and I want to see if you can clear this up. Did HBO pay him?
They paid everybody.
They did. How much did he get paid? I mean, because I would think that the more they offered him, the crazier he would act. Am I wrong to assume that?
No, but also the whole practice of paying people for documentaries, because basically Joe Berlinger and Bruce Sinofsky, the producers of the Paradise Lost films, they consider themselves journalists, and journalists generally do not pay the subjects of their stories. But they had a long and complicated reason for it, and I'm not going to criticize them for it, but they gave Mark and Melissa, the Hobbs, the Moores, and the Eccles, Miss Kellys, and Hobbs families all got $7,500. They called it an honorarium. Mark just happened to be around for the second film because the others wouldn't have anything to do with it. So he got a second honorarium to do the second film.
$7,500. Wow, that just seems really minuscule compared to what he went through. Well, now
people are very poor, and it seems like
it's a lot of money. Don't get me wrong, but I'm just surprised at that amount. I thought it would be a lot more. Let's talk about your book. Tell us what exactly you wanted to accomplish with this book, and how does it look at this case? What's different about your book than everybody else's?
Well, the main thing that's different is that it focuses on Mark Byers, and it does get into the case very deeply, because you can't separate Mark and the case. Without the case, without the murders, Mark Byers is just another guy. But he had been, when, at the time I undertook the story, which was 2005, Mark was still very heavily of the belief that the West Memphis Three were guilty. And so we started writing with getting his side of what happened in the films. That was really one of the main goals, was to and Mara Leverett's book, Devil's Knot, was released in 2003, and it also heavily implicated Mark. So we wanted to get the other side of the story out. And, of course, what happened was in 2007, when all the new DNA evidence came in and Lori Davis got her forensics teams in there with Dr. Spitz and Baden and John Douglas of the FBI. In fact, it was John Douglas who really sat down with Mark and laid out the evidence for him and convinced him that, in his mind anyway, the West Memphis Three were innocent and somebody else was guilty. So that's what we really started the book, and it's always evolved right up until the end of the case. I remember when the Alford plea was announced, Mark called me up before the day before it was announced to the public, and he said, "Well, I guess we know how the book is going to end."
And
it did, because up until then, I honestly didn't know. This wasn't supposed to be a 7-year project. But
well,
I think they got a good look at you know, Mark in context with the crime, explaining his behavior, and telling, expanding a little more on the deal that the West Memphis Three ended up striking. I'm sure that Mara Leverett's book will cover that in more detail, but I'm first. So.
Well, you are, and you have certainly have the unique look at the whole case, because nobody's done it before. It's always focused on the West Memphis Three. Real briefly, the West Memphis Three, they were arrested because Miss Kelly is basically borderline retarded. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's true.
And they basically told him what to say, and he was just kind of led very easily. And we know now, thanks to the Crow case and others, that it is very easy, borderline retarded or not, that when you're put in a stressful situation under police questioning, you know, the strongest of a person can be made to say, yes, I did it, when they really didn't. And that's what started this whole thing. And what I find absolutely shocking is the prosecutor still, doesn't he still feel that they have the right, they had the right people, or am I wrong?
Yeah, you're asking me to read somebody's mind. I have no idea.
I thought I heard him say that he felt they had the right people. I mean, that to me is just appalling.
Yes.
When you
certainly the Attorney General, Dustin McDaniel, is still standing by the convictions. Scott Ellington has moved on to public office now. He's running for U.S. representatives, and that's what everybody's trying to do, is to move themselves out of the case as quickly as they possibly can. And their official position is that they support the verdicts, but what they really believe, I have no idea.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's right. I know they believe they couldn't convict them if they tried
again.
But
right.
Do they believe they're innocent? I don't know.
So when you started the book, did you think he was guilty, John?
No. Oh, God, I never thought Mark was guilty.
John Mark. Does he go by Mark or John?
He goes by Mark.
Okay, so didn't think Mark Byers was guilty, even after the HBO special and everything. You knew it was just basically a role he was playing, almost.
It was too obvious, and I never really understood how anybody could think that. You know, they could think all sorts of other things about him. My biggest thought about him was that, you know, he was a ham.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yes,
he couldn't stay away from a microphone or a TV camera. And, you know, he was constantly sticking his foot in his mouth. But I never believed he was a killer.
Let me tell you two things that didn't help him. And I want you to weigh in on it, okay? We're talking with Greg Day, author of Untying the Knot, John Mark Byers and the West Memphis Three. The book is a look at the West Memphis Three case through John Mark Byers' story. Supposedly, he was supposed to go on the Lisa show. Remember, Lisa Gibbons had a show? And
yes,
they had. Oh, yeah, he did. That's right. He did. And, oh, that's right. And on the show, they were talking about a bite mark expert. And then later I read, and I don't know if it's true, that they were going to be able to match the teeth. Did he get all his teeth pulled after that? because I remember reading that and thinking, what? So there's this teeth mark expert, teeth bite expert, and they're talking about it, and they're going to compare his teeth to this mark, and then all of a sudden he gets his teeth pulled. Is that a rumor?
Yeah.
Is that a rumor or what?
No, that's essentially true. The part of it is true. He did get his teeth pulled, but the bite mark, alleged bite mark, was not a human bite mark, and the guy who identified it as a human bite mark, his name is Brent Turvey, was absolutely 100% unqualified and wrong. And when he went to testify at Damien Echols' Rule 37 hearing, that's when all this came about, and they were going to try and introduce this bite mark evidence. Turvey had to admit that he was not qualified as a forensic odontologist, and he wasn't allowed to testify. And all the experts now will tell you that mark up there, that it was one particular, they call it a dome-shaped pattern abrasion that was over Stevie Branch's left eye. It's not a bite mark. So
what?
Mark didn't help himself because he told I don't know if you know who the KGB is.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, he had told them that, you know, he'd gotten his teeth pulled before the murders, when, in fact, he did it afterwards.
After. And it was after the Lisa show, if I remember correctly. Why don't you tell us about the KBG?
No, it was before the Lisa show because lost his dentures at the Lisa show.
Oh, my gosh.
He did the whole show without his dentures because he had left them at a pizza restaurant the night before.
Oh, man.
The story's in the book, too, and they ended up tossing him into a dumpster, so he went dumpster diving for his teeth after the show. A L.A. cop came along and chased him out of the dumpster, and he said, I'm not going anywhere without my teeth. He went back in there, and he found his teeth, and he left. But yeah, he did do the interview without – but they never aired the show.
That's right.
And Mark's part was done separately because the other people, they were the Damien Echols' mother, Jason Baldwin's mother, a couple of other people were in another studio, and they didn't want to appear with Mark. So they got to see everything Mark said, and Mark didn't get to see anything that they said. And the transcript of Mark's interview with Lisa is on the Internet, has been for years. But the other one with all the experts and the and Echols' parents and Baldwin's parents, that they've been lost. I mean, they're not anywhere to be found. I've tried to get a hold of Lisa Gibbons, and they're not answering.
He went dumpster diving for his teeth. So that just fits perfectly.
Yeah,
it does.
Suit and cowboy boots.
Oh, that is too funny. Tell us, who is the KGB? Give us.
Really, it's shorthand for Kathy Bakken, Grove Pashley, and Burke Sauls, and they are the people who really took the case from Paradise Lost 1.
Right.
Kathy Bakken was doing key art for an ad agency, and she was doing the movie poster for it, and she previewed the movie, and she sent it to Burke, and they all powwowed on, and they decided this was outrageous, and they started collecting information and evidence and putting it out on the Internet. So the movie, without the movie, there'd be no KGB, and without the KGB, there'd be no Free the West Memphis 3. I'm convinced.
That's right. And that's KGB is not the Russian secret police, people. It's
not in this case.
No, it's three people who did something very, very good. And that's just a great story in itself, these people coming together, and they have nothing to gain by doing this, and they just put their lives on hold to free these innocent men. Okay, here's the other thing that John Mark Byers did he had apparently nothing to do with it, but it just seems suspicious. His wife that was in the first movie died, and last I heard, they don't know how she died. She's died in her sleep. Is that correct?
That's fact. That death is still officially listed as undetermined.
Undetermined.
Right. She died of undetermined causes. I cover that in detail in the book as far as taking the autopsy report, because Mark insisted on an autopsy because he didn't know how she died either. And, this poor woman was a train wreck. You know, she had high blood sugar, high potassium. She had hardening of the arteries. She was a narcotics abuser. She had tried to commit suicide. She never got over Christopher's death. She had legal problems of her own because both her and Mark had been arrested for 3 felony burglaries. And she herself had been arrested for threatening some linoleum installers with a shotgun. And
lovely.
She died before she ever had to face trial. But the point is that there was a million other things that could have caused her death, but they couldn't find any one thing that in and of itself would have caused her death, and mm-hmm. they listed it as undetermined. State police closed their case. Oh, gosh, I think they kept it open for a year, but to the best of my knowledge, Dale Lever up in Sharp County, where they were living and where the autopsy was done, has still kept his case open. I spoke with him once, and he still thinks Mark did something.
Well, I mean, you can kind of see why people would think that, just if you only go by what you saw on TV, because he is such, like you said, a character. And that's why I think this book is so important, because, you know, he's not an angel by any means, but he apparently isn't a killer either. And it's not fair that he is being called that or being suspected of that. And
I'm
think
glad you used that phrase, he's not an angel, because the second chapter is called I'm No Angel.
That's exactly right. Now, speaking of that, I want to switch here just a little bit, because I remember in the third Paradise Lost, Byers was talking about what John Douglas told him. And John Douglas, that is the FBI profiler, told him that Stephen Branch's father... Compared to Stevie Branch's father, Mark Byers was an angel. Does that sound right? Am I getting that correct?
It sounds right that he would have said that. I'm not sure I'd agree with it.
But isn't Stephen Branch's father, what is his first name? I apologize. I don't have it on my list here.
His name is Terry Hobbs, because he's a
Yeah, stepfather. Terry Hobbs. Isn't he kind of the guy now that everybody's kind of zeroing in on the West Memphis Three?
Oh, yeah, he's totally the guy.
What do you think?
Unequivocally that he's the guy.
Right.
I met with Terry Hobbs once for about an hour, and I I've met with several killers before, and I if they weren't behind bars, I wouldn't
yes.
necessarily know that they were killers.
Right.
Terry Hobbs, you know, my opinion is kind of meaningless. I don't really know.
No, it's not. I want to know it. It's not meaningless. But you don't have to say. That's fine. I know you have to be objective.
I'm not really sure, about Terry Hobbs, except that if it came down to the two of them, yeah, I'd be looking at Terry Hobbs. And all John Douglas has really said is that if his guys had come to him during the murders when they first happened and talked about Terry Hobbs, he would have said, put this guy on the front burner.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, from what I understand, and this is just about the case specifically, Terry Hobbs, he has lied about being with the boys the day they were killed. Is that correct? Is that the accusation now?
That's the accusation.
Right. Tell us about it.
Two of the neighbors swore affidavits that they had seen. They lived two doors down from Terry, and they'd seen the boys there. And in fact, one of the girls had told Christopher to go home because his brother was looking for him. He was supposed to be home for dinner,
mm-hmm.
which it checks out in one respect because Christopher disappeared for dinner, and Mark was upset with him for not being there. The only thing is that, they say, well, they know it was a Wednesday night, and this is back in 1993, and these girls mm-hmm. were, 11 and 13 or something, and they know it was a Wednesday night because they went to youth group, but, I don't know that they could really be sure that it was that Wednesday night because one of the things that the older girl had said, Jamie Ballard, I think her name is, and she had said that she knew that that's when it was because the next day she saw Ryan, Christopher's brother, in school.
Mm-hmm.
And Ryan was like junior high. And Ryan said, she told Ryan that she had seen Christopher and he got really upset with her. Why didn't you, tell me Christopher was supposed to come home? And the reason that that's hinky is because I don't know that Ryan would have been in school that day.
Well, yeah, that is kind of, you need to look at that, because if your little brother's missing, you don't go to school. You know,
no,
you stay home.
Like midnight the night before searching with Mark.
Right, right.
So he got to bed very late, and
well, that would be easy to
Mark
disprove them. You could just look at the attendance records and see if he was there.
Well, that's
then,
what I said. I've tried to get many things out of Arkansas that are difficult to get, and that could be one of them. But
mm-hmm.
You would have thought that the attorneys taking the affidavits would have gone there unless they just decided that they would take their word for it.
Well, you can't take their word for it when you're dealing with a murder case, for God's sakes. You got to check it out.
We're looking at building building a house out of little components, because that's how cases are built, and
yeah.
They think that this is another straw on the camel's back. I think mm-hmm. it's the weakest one, but
what do you think is the
strongest one? Yeah, well, the strongest one is the for sure is the hair.
Okay, tell us about the hair.
Terry's hair, well, let's go. It's mitochondrial DNA, which is traceable mm-hmm. through the mother's line. Hairs similar to Terry Hobbs were found tied in the ligature that bound Michael Moore.
Mm-hmm.
And that would have been shoelaces.
Right.
His neighbor, David Jacoby, his a hair that was similar to his was found on a tree stump at the crime scene.
Mm-hmm.
Again, the numbers kind of vary, and I'm not a DNA expert, but I remember it being, in Hobbs' case, something like you could eliminate all but 7% of the population. In Jacoby's case, you could eliminate all but 3%, something like that.
So let me stop you there for a second. Are people suggesting that the neighbor, Jacoby, was there at the crime scene at the time?
No, most people are not.
Okay.
What they're suggesting is that...
Transference?
Terry Hobbs, yes, exactly, secondary transfer, because Terry went to David's house finally he admitted it when they finally talked to him, 13, mm-hmm. 14, 15 years later, and David Jacoby has also said, yeah, when Terry dropped Pam off at work, Stevie was still missing,
mm-hmm.
and instead of going to look for him, he went over to David's house and played guitar for an hour, then he left.
That's
and said,
weird.
I'll be back later. And he was allegedly going to check and see if Stevie had come home or not.
Mm-hmm.
So what most people believe is that if that is, in fact, David Jacoby's hair at the crime scene, it got there from secondary transfer.
Right. What motive would Terry Hobbs have to kill these three boys? Just speculation here.
Yeah, well, Douglas had to come up with a motive, and so I'll go with his.
Okay.
He believes that it was a disciplinary situation that got out of control, because Stevie was supposed to be home
mm-hmm.
by 4:30. He was definitely supposed to be home before his mother went to work at 5, and he wasn't. And Terry may have gone to David's, played guitar for an hour, gone back to his house, seen that Stevie was not there.
Mm-hmm.
And knowing that, I don't know, there's a question as to whether David saw them. He thinks he saw the boys riding by his house when Terry was there. But
David, is that the neighbor? Is that the neighbor?
Yeah, David Jacoby.
Okay, okay.
And there's also a woman, Deborah Otinger, who said for sure she saw the boys cutting through her property.
I remember reading that, right.
Yeah, on the way to Robin Hood Hill. So there's any number of one of the reasons why Terry would have gone to Robin Hood Hills looking for Stevie,
The three of them? What? I don't get it.
Douglas says it got out of hand, and
mm-hmm.
once he got too physical with Stevie, he had to kill everybody to cover it up.
Wow, that's cold, man. That is so cold. It is, but you know what? Somebody did it, so they're obviously a monster.
Right. Somebody did it. You're right.
So what is Terry Hobbs doing now? Has he kind of gone underground? Is he just staying out of everybody's way?
No, he is still working at the same he works at a hardware store, and when I met with him, he was still there, and I'm pretty sure he's still there, because he said the people there were very supportive of him, and they were
mm-hmm.
chasing off any reporters or whatever that came looking for him. So to the best of my knowledge, he's just very comfortable, and I don't think he's gone underground at all.
Well, Terry Hobbs, scary man. I wouldn't want to be married to him. Didn't he threaten to kill his wife? And, I mean, there's violence in the marriage. Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly.
Very scary man.
And I would love to get this videotaped. One of his, according to the evidence, one of their fights was videotaped at a bar.
Oh, my God.
I would have liked to have seen that. But he did, for sure, at least on one occasion, you know, hit her with a clenched fist. She claimed her jaw was broken. She called her family, and her brother and father came down. Brother was a big old guy, and
mm-hmm.
family enforcer, and Terry was ready for him. Instead of leaving, Terry just stuffed a 357 in his pants and waited for
the brother.
Jackie Hicks Jr., who has since died. And he shot him in the abdomen.
He shot him?
He shot him, yeah.
Oh, my God. And so this is, oh, boy, that poor kid. Those poor kids. I mean, my gosh. Just thinking about the life that his son must have been living with that man, whether he did it or not, he sounds like somebody that would not be good around kids at all. That poor child. Really? What?
I would suggest talking to the family.
Really?
The Hicks family.
They say he's a good guy around kids?
No.
Oh, just the opposite.
Not at all.
Okay.
They just have stories that I wouldn't repeat because they've been known to throw a lot of wild pitches, and I'm not in that business.
There you go. Yeah. Why stick a stick in a hornet's nest? I understand. What are the West Memphis Three, Damian Echols, Jason Baldwin, and Jesse Miss Kelly, doing now? Are they still appealing? What's going on?
Okay, here's what's going on. Aside from their public lies, with the case, they're not officially appealing. Well, I shouldn't say that. They have been petitioning Scott Ellington, who's the DA out there in Craighead County, to reopen the case based on, you know, the things that they've come up with, the affidavits of the girls, you know, the hairs, whatever, because they never got to present their evidence.
Right.
You know, I was at the Supreme Court hearing where they heard Echols' case, and unanimously, 9 jurors sent it back down to the Second District and said, you got it, because Judge Burnett had denied them evidentiary hearing.
Don't get me going about that, Judge.
Yeah, well, I stuck up for him for a long time, but I don't think he's worth anything. At least David Laser made sure to get something done, because he got this, and he said, we have to do this evidentiary hearing. What's the point? If we get... just on the juror misconduct issue alone, which is probably
That is a whole other book. I want people to look into that. That juror misconduct. You know what? That's so important. Let's just in a couple of paragraphs tell us about that, because that's extremely important.
It is. It's huge. It's really it's the linchpin to the whole.
It is. It is.
There was a juror who tried his best to get on the Echols-Baldwin jury, a prospective juror, during voir dire. He lied about a lot of stuff. He lied about his knowledge of the case when, in fact, he was deeply into it. He read about it every day. He knew everything about it, and he wanted on the case. And unfortunately for him, he had confided in his attorney that not only did he want to get on this case, but he wanted to know how he could lead the jurors in the right direction. And this was later on during the case, because he said that the jurors were, that the prosecution wasn't making his case, and he was afraid that these guys were going to walk, and asked this lawyer friend of his what to do. Well, this lawyer was only a lawyer for this realtor's business. So it wasn't a privileged conversation that he had with them. So eventually the lawyer turned him in through a sealed affidavit, and these affidavids remain sealed for a long time. This is not new stuff. But it was going to get open. The Supreme Court ordered it unsealed, and they were going to hear this stuff at an evidentiary hearing, and just on that alone, they would have had to order new trials.
Yes, absolutely. And so anyway,
what I did is he got the Miss Kelly confession introduced into the jury room, and that was not allowed.
That's right. How did he do that?
He just did it.
Oh, my God.
They didn't, you know, and in fact, they found the juror charts, and there was some items scratched off on it,
mm-hmm.
and one of the jurors had taken very good notes, and she had written both sides, pros and cons, and on the con side was written Jesse Miscalli's confession.
Oh, no.
But they scratched it out on target. Somebody had said, oh, no, we're not allowed to consider that. But, you know, that's the bell being
How do you unring that bell?
That was a poison jury from, you know, from the beginning.
From the beginning. So, and let's get back, and then I know we have to wrap it up here in a bit, but let's get back to what the West Memphis Three are doing today. We were talking about how they are appealing their case or what they're doing with their case right now.
Right. They've still got, and some of it I can't talk about, but they still have investigators working on items of evidence, some of which is really shocking.
give us a little bit. Just a little. No one's
listening. Well, Peter Jackson is still involved.
Uh-huh.
Who's
Lord
he? Of the Rings.
Oh, the Lord of the Rings guy. Okay, that's who I thought it was, but
yeah.
I couldn't believe it. Okay, right.
Sir Peter Jackson.
Sir Peter, right.
He's kicking in a lot of money. In the past, a lot of it came from Johnny Depp and Eddie Vedder.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that because Damien Eccles has actually spent a lot of time in New Zealand with Peter Jackson. He's
mm-hmm.
even thinking of moving there. But they're going behind the scenes, digging into old items of evidence that, how can I say this?
You know what? We won't tell. I swear. Everybody... They promise. All the listeners promise never to say a word. Just
Can
tell
we get
us.
Their names?
Yes. I'll give them all. Jane and John Doe, that's everybody.
They are just, there are things that they've found that links to Terry Hobbs
mm-hmm.
that are
shocking.
Very damaging. And there may be other things that they're working on. I mean, in fact, I'm sure there are many more things that they're looking at than I know about. But they're pushing hard to get these things to, you know, the reopen a case. It's the only thing they
mm-hmm.
can do.
Right.
It's reopened. And so,
boy, in Arkansas, that's going to
reopen the case. I don't know.
What do you think? Well, in Arkansas, I mean, would they ever be able to admit that they made a mistake? That's the problem. I mean, for the West Memphis Three to get out in that Alford plea, they had to agree not to sue for wrongful prosecution. I don't blame them for signing that, but I think that is such a cowardly thing for the prosecutor to put in. What is he afraid of? The truth? Why doesn't he want the truth?
Lawyers hate Alford pleas for that very reason. But they stood up in court ever since they were first introduced in the 60s. Henry Alford was the guy.
Right.
They accept them, and, you know, how could they do it? Well, it was a...
I'm talking about the prosecution, not the three guys. The prosecution. How could they put something in there, not allowing them to sue or to agree that, you know? I mean, basically, they cut off their ability almost to get back something for all the years they spent in prison. That's what I'm upset about.
Tricia. But I think you have to look at the West Memphis Three compared to the hundreds or maybe thousands of nameless people out there. There's been like 2,500 Alford pleas since it first took hold. And
mm-hmm.
they don't have the notoriety that the West Memphis Three are. They'll never be able to get their names cleared. At least if the West Memphis Three get their names cleared. See, if they get their names cleared, then I don't know that they're not able to sue.
Exactly. I think that's what I'm hoping. They'll get their names clear, and then they can. Only because I find that the prosecution for making them agree to that is so cowardly. You know, if you believe in something, stand up and say, I'm sorry, I think they're guilty. And if you want to sue me, go ahead. We'll just get the evidence. Well, they don't want to be sued because they know they're not guilty, but they won't admit it. And that's what I'm saying. How can they get the case reopened in Arkansas when nobody in Arkansas wants to have anything to do with it? Do you think that could ever really, truly happen?
Well, it certainly would be an uphill battle, but I'll tell you that the way I thought this case was going to end in the very beginning was that either Mike Huckabee or Mike Beebe, governors of Arkansas, would commute Damien Echols' sentence from death to life without parole, and mm-hmm. that would take all the public pressure, because, you know, a death sentence is pretty potent.
That was, yeah.
You take that away, and people might lose interest, and I really thought that's the way they were going to go.
Mm-hmm.
They probably wish that that's the way they went.
Yes.
Because as it is now, they're out free, making a lot of noise, and nobody can stop them. So.
Absolutely. And on that note, Mr. Day, we will leave it. Give us the address of your website, please.
Yes, the website is www.johnmarkbyers.com.
And it is a fascinating book. I can't wait to delve into it. I've just gotten into it a little bit, but I'm going to probably stay up all night and read it. It's Untying the Knot, John Mark Byers and the West Memphis Three. The author is Greg Day. And, Mr. Day, thank you so much for joining us on True Crime Radio. And if there's any new developments, don't hesitate to let us know. We'll have you on again, okay?
I'll be in touch, Trish. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Wow, Kim. Stir.
You can call me Kim.
Okay. Wow. I mean, I could talk to that guy all day. There is so much stuff in the West Memphis 3 that when you sit down and really take a look at the case, it will anger you and appall you to no end that this could happen. And like Mr. Day said, these guys get publicity. What about all the other cases that don't? That's what's so frustrating. So let's hope that Damien Echols teaming up with the director, Sir Peter Jackson, because money talks, and Jackson has the bucks, and Peter Jackson financing this, I think they'll be able to accomplish something, definitely. So we'll definitely keep you updated on that. But Kimster, we have an incredible Webb Sleuth's Hot Cold Case. Tell us about it.
Do, 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 do.
Oh, that's right. I need to get our little horn thing. I'll do that next week, I promise.
Well, Tricia, this week brings us one of the most bizarre cold cases that our members have brought up in the unidentified forum. Really bizarre. Mm-hmm. Robert Meredith was last seen in Evansville, Indiana in 1979. You're probably going, wait a minute, we're talking about the unidentified forum, and I just said that Robert Meredith is the one that's been missing, but hold on there. His wife was the last known person to see him alive. They got into a fight, and she asked him to leave, and he was never seen again. His wife never filed a missing person report with the police either. His sister went to the Evansville police in 1992 in an effort to revive her brother's case, and it was then she learned that by 1992, Robert Meredith had already been declared dead by his ex-wife. Robert Meredith had at least 8 children with 4 wives throughout his life. Many of those children didn't know about each other until they began looking into their dad's disappearance. And in a statement to the Social Security Administration, Meredith's wife, at the time he disappeared, said that she received collect calls and letters from Robert Meredith in Florida afterward. But to this date, there's no evidence of his existence since the day he left in 1979. So there's a little bit of a background, and now get this. We have a new member on Web Sleuth named Dippy Blonder. Mm-hmm. She found an unidentified man out of Broward County, Florida, who looks amazingly like Robert Meredith.
Wow.
In fact, Robert had a full set of dentures, and so did this unidentified man. And do you remember what I said about Robert's wife telling Social Security that Robert called collect from Florida?
Yes.
Well, that's where this unidentified man is at in Florida.
Okay.
So what do you think happened? Is this Robert Meredith? Will his children finally find out what happened to him? In order to get involved in this case as it unfolds, because this is a hot one right now,
mm-hmm.
and to learn about helping give the unidentified a name, please go to www.websleuth.com, and in the upper right-hand corner, you'll see a composite sketch along with the link to this thread. And if you're not a member of Web Sleuth, what do?
You join, by golly, because it's free, and all we need is an email address. That's it. right?
This is a really, really interesting case, you guys. So if you are a member, get over there right away. If you're not, hurry up and get registered, because I'll tell you what, it's unfolding now. We have a brand new member that brought this up, and it's really interesting. So get involved in it right now.
And that's just it, Kimster. Brand new member, Dippity Blonder. We don't know who she is, don't know her real name, might even be a guy, we don't know. New member, came on, doesn't, you know, have a lot of experience or anything, just came on and thought, I'll give this a shot, and did it, and look what happened. That just proves to those of you out there listening who have not joined and who think, oh, I couldn't offer anything, wrong-o, you certainly can. Again, I want to stress, even if it's a, we're thinking of you to a, on a thread about a missing person, that helps the family members more than you know. And you just might break a case. It happens all the time. In fact, I'm going to be putting together a show about our unidentified forum and all the great posters that are in there working on those cases day in and day out. Nobody knows about them. Nobody hears about them. They don't do it for the attention, but I'm going to give them some attention because they certainly deserve it. And that will be coming up in some later shows a little bit later on. Kimster, is there anything else going on that we need to discuss, or have we wrapped it up, or what the heck do I need to do next? You tell me. You're my producer.
Well, I do want to remind everyone to say a prayer for the family of Linnea Lomax. We did discuss her with Mark Klass on this case. She was found this week, and she was not alive, and her family is deeply grieving for her. So please remember to keep them in your thoughts and prayers.
And I want to bring up something about this, Kimster. You and I were talking about this off the air. First of all, I want to do this legal ease, and that will explain as I go into this. The opinions expressed on the shows are those of the guests and the host. That would be moi, and I take no responsibility for them, especially my own. Web Sleuth Radio, actually it's Trisha's True Crime Radio, is not the same as WebSleuth.com, which is a completely different corporate entity, and it's not the same as ForumsForJustice.org. So what I say here doesn't mean you can take it over to WebSleuth.com, but I can talk about WebSleuth.com, and let me tell you about Linnea Lomax. In the Lomax case, we had some posters who were, the deal was she was in a psychiatric facility, and she vanished. And there were people saying she just wanted to get away. You know, leave her alone. She wants to be left alone. Well, what that does is that makes it so nobody will go search for her. If people think that a person just walked away, they're not going to spend their valuable time trying to find them. They're not going to try and find somebody that doesn't want to be found. So when people post things like that, like they did in the Lomax case, saying she didn't want to be found, that hurts the search and that hurts the family. And you know what? She didn't just vanish on her own and wanted to be alone. She's dead. So to those people that tried to disrupt that thread nonstop by saying that she wanted to be alone and to leave her alone, you should be ashamed of yourselves, because that hurt the case. And thank goodness we had so many searchers show up that were dedicated, and people that had accredited search dogs that were there, and the Class Kids Search Center came, and they didn't listen to those people saying she wants to be left alone. They knew that she didn't want to be left alone at all. And it was very tragic. They're looking into the cause of death right now. It doesn't look suspicious, but they haven't said that for sure yet. So let's just, like you said, say a little prayer for the families, and please keep in mind, when you post something, those words are powerful. And I know a lot of people, because they don't have to show their face or give their real name, they feel more powerful, and you can do damage like that. So please think before your post. Okay, I'm done scolding. How's that?
Thank you.
You're
well,
welcome.
And that, not only just that, but also be careful what you say about the family too.
Yes.
Because they're grieving, and you know, I wish sometimes they wouldn't look, but they do look because they're hoping to find a tip or a clue to find their loved one.
Or they're looking for something nice, you know.
Yeah.
And then they have somebody say, oh, I think the dad's a this and that. And, you know, think about it. For God's sakes, you are tearing people's hearts out when you write cruel things like that. And that's why we try and get them off Web Sleuth. So that's why Web Sleuth, you know, a lot of our time is spent trying to make sure that none of these mean things are up there, and that we have you know, that we're able to verify people and that we keep the threads on topic. There's a reason for the things that we do. So I know the people listening now are not any of those people that have done those things. So it's just
no,
the good people
no.
listening. Yes, just the good ones.
No, but those good people, if you see those kind of posts, be sure to alert so
alert.
The moderators see it too.
Right, and this is, goes for forumsforjustice.org and websleuths.com. The alert button, if you see a post that you feel is inappropriate, the alert button is in the upper right-hand corner. It's actually a red triangle, white in the middle, and just click on that, and you can follow the directions from there. Well, Kimster, another show, another day, and next week it is going to be an amazing show. You know how I know?
No, how do you know?
Thank you very much. You took a beat there, but you got it. I know because we're going to talk about true crime, and true crime is always fascinating. It's Trisha's True Crime Radio with Kimster and all of you, where we discuss current events and true crime, and we always do it with common sense. Good night, everybody.
Good night.